Welcome to Awakening Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning to everyone who has dialed in from around the world. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening across all of our time zones. My name is Trishna, and I'm going to be the host for today's Awaken Call with Mike Dixon. So today, as you know, our special guest is Mike Dixon here in the UK. I'm actually based in London, and Mike normally is as well, but today he's dialing in from the southern part of England. And Mike is somebody who really embodies the theme that we're talking about today, which is the theme of exercising our generosity gene. Today, our call is going to be moderated by Aria Cooper-Smith, who is one of our volunteers based in the U.S. as well. And he will engage in a deeper dialogue with Mike. Thank you, Aria, for joining us. And perhaps you can share some reflections.
So good to be with you on this call and everyone here. Brief intro to Mike. His life is basically about encouraging people to be generous and to guide them so that their giving can be as effective as possible. And he's been doing this work in a number of ways. One of them is as founder of the Rainmaker Foundation. And the Rainmaker Foundation is a community dedicated to making the world a better place for all. The patron of the Rainmaker Foundation is Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And their members are founders, entrepreneurs, senior leaders from a range of industries, including tech, media, finance, and law. And while their backgrounds are diverse, they all share a track record of creating effective change and a desire to make a difference. Mike is also author of a book, Our Generous Gene. And on the website in describing this, it says, if we want a world with the least misery and the most happiness, everyone has to play a part. We need to cultivate our generous gene. And he quotes Margaret Mead, who says famously, never believe that a few caring people can't change the world, for indeed, that's all who ever have. Mike's story, which is pretty amazing and dramatic, is that more than 20 years ago, he was challenged to run for the first time the London Marathon. He accepted the challenge. And at around the same time, he had encountered a limited mobility child with cerebral palsy who had entered his store in Covent Garden with a motorized wheelchair. And at that time, he had the thought, if we're going to go 26 miles and try to get around, we should try it and do it with a purpose. We should try and give mobility for a child who can't move. After he had this series of experiences, he co-founded a children's charity called WizKids, which provides mobility equipment for disabled children and is now the largest UK supplier of pediatric mobility aids in the UK outside of the British National Health System. And the story goes on and on. So, Mike Dixon, thank you so much for your time and welcome to the Awaken Call.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Trishna, and thank you, Aure. And, welcome to you from the tip of Cornwall. In fact, very near Land's End. It's nearly the end of the known world.
Sounds wonderful. If I look out from here over the Pacific and through a couple of continents, I can almost see you over there.
Great.
So I'd like to start off with kind of today about the Rainmaker Foundation. Can you tell us a little more about the Rainmaker Foundation and what are some of the main activities that you're up to right now?
Well, we started it about 4 years ago, in January 2012. And the aim was to create a community of people who were dedicated to helping others and making change and bring them together regularly in events and so forth and introduce them at the same time to people who are real change makers, i.e. the people who had started wonderful causes all over the world, a complete variety of leaders of NGOs and inspirational cases. And basically what we do is we introduce one lot, i.e. people who have the resources, be it money or time or skills or talent, to the people who run these NGOs all over the world. And they help them. So in simple language, it's a mixture of, between inspiring one lot on the other hand, on one hand, and matchmaking on the other. And last year, for example, we were able to help over 100 charities throughout the world, which do all sorts of things, some frontline helping to ease frontline poverty in the UK, trafficking, human rights, the environment, poverty in India, you know, conservation, almost everything you can imagine. It's a very broad sweep. The secret is to inspire the people to help the people who are creating change. That's what we do.
It just strikes me, listening to you describe this again, Mike, of just what a highly leveraged activity this is, that by introducing these people to each other, you're facilitating change in so many places in so many ways.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, it's and what's most interesting is that it only needs a few people to latch on. So recently we took part in a private lunch in London to support a woman who was campaigning to eliminate FGC. And 17 people turned up, and six of them were rainmakers. And this wonderful woman called Julia, who had started, she'd given up her career to start this campaign to eliminate FGC. You know, and they all came together.
What is FGC?
Female genital cutting. Female genital
mutilation.
In Africa and things like that. And you know, so it's not an easy subject to talk about or to raise money for. And 17 of these people raised something like £140,000, and offered their talents and went on the board and this sort of thing for a particular woman to do her work. And I think it sums up. You know, one of our donors said, you know, there are things that you want to see done in the world, values that you hold dear, things that you really care about, but you actually haven't got the talent, time or the talent or the skills to actually do anything. But what you can do is you can find people who are making real difference in the world and you can support them. And that's such a good way of working. And I'm sure that, yeah, a huge number of the service-based community do this already. And so basically, I'm just another cog in the wheel, really. I try and find groups of people to support wonderful causes all over the world.
So I'm curious, when you started the Rainmaker Foundation, the rainmakers, the people who are the donors, where did you find them? How did you find them? How do you bring them together?
Well, it's sort of evolution, really. I mean, from my background running WizKids, it was a story about how I first discovered people's natural generosity, really. But when I started WizKids, and then we did succession planning and handed it on to someone else, to run, which they're doing very well. And I sort of was gathering knowledge of other charities and donors and so on. And then I started advising individuals and companies about how to give money to charities. And then I wrote a book, first ever book I wrote about generosity, which is called Please Take One Step, which was given away free to all the people who attended a TED Global conference in Oxford in 2010. And because it was just after the financial crash, you know, TED's a famously sort of thought leadership organization. And the thought that you should lead a generous life was became almost like rocket science in the context of the crash and what had happened in there. And so I landed up with what was then I called my BlackBerry. You know, I had about 50 people I knew who had resources, not just money, but mainly money. And on the other hand, about 30 or 40 charities that I knew really well. I knew the founders of them. And, you know, that actually, you know, the book went down so well that we created Rainmaker. And then, you know, lots and lots of people became enthusiastic about helping and joining the community. So they introduced each other. We discovered all sorts of other charities that they wanted to help throughout the world. And so it just grew. And now it's got a couple of hundred people who are useful, if you like, and a couple of hundred charities all around the world that we help.
It sounds like you basically persisted in doing what you cared about doing and reaching out to people through different channels, and over time this community came together.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you know, this, I think that, you know, people who, particularly in the world, so you can help people, and we've got lots of stories in the book about you can be generous and help other people in many, many, many ways. But my particular aspect of starting Rainmaker was to encourage people who had done really well in life and had got quite enough, a famous sort of Mike expression, to get a grip and help people who were less fortunate than themselves. And it just happens to be an inspired idea. If you introduce people who've done quite well in life, who are successful, but not necessarily significant, if you introduce them to people who are literally trying to save the environment or helping the poverty in India or getting people off death row, whatever you're doing, if you introduce people to each other, it's just extraordinary what happens, because, you know, 9 out of 10 times they become inspired by each other. And that's the powerful thing.
Yeah, that really sounds powerful indeed. And I'm very much struck as you describe the rainmakers, the extraordinarily successful people who you are kind of leading to from being successful to also being significant. I'm struck by how much this does for them as well as for the recipients of the donations. And I'm wondering if you can give us one or two examples of these successful people who, as a result of connecting with the change makers, really experience change in their own lives.
Well, I can probably carry on till about 9 o'clock tonight doing that.
I bet.
I mean, specifically, you know, one very nice friend of mine is a senior UK businessman, and he did quite well. He got us an amount of money, put it into a charitable foundation, which he runs with his daughters, and proceeded to distribute it. And he is distributing some every year. But there was one story, which we spoke about before, where he and his daughter, the doctor, were in Cornwall, and they came across a family that had a disabled child. And the donor, a friend of mine called Crispin, said to this family, you know, so said to the mother, well, what do you do? And she said, well, I used to be a teacher, but I had to give it up to look after my disabled child 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And Crispin and his daughter, you know, they were very moved by this story. So to cut a long story short, after several weeks and more conversations, they decided to give the family a holiday once a year and to provide a carer 1 day a week for this family, so that the mother had 1 day off a week. So this sort of revolutionized and changed her life. It gave her 1 day a week of a respite, I suppose. Mm. And Crispin was telling me this story, and he said, you know, we were reviewing our foundation's work at the end of the year, and we came to the conclusion that this was by far the most powerful thing we'd done all year, and it cost them all of £5,000, which writes a lot of money, but it's not put against philanthropy money. It's not much at all. It's a small amount and a lot of thought and a lot of care to help a family who are having a hard time. And I think that's a wonderful story. And on the other... Sorry, go on.
Go ahead, yeah.
No, and then we've got two other husband and wife team who he works in a hedge fund, and they're clients of ours. And 3 years ago, they asked us to find five charities in the north of England, run by heroes that were terribly small, and helping young people living in poverty in the north of England. So that was specific. The charities had to be little, very, very small. They had to be run by heroes, and they had to be engaged in helping disadvantaged young people. And we went through a process, and eventually this couple gave five different, very small organizations £100,000 over 3 years, i.e. £30,000 a year, per year, and they gave each of them £100,000, so that was £500,000. And they gave them, basically, by giving them each individual charity £100,000 over 3 years, they were basically underwriting a salary or covering the costs of a new project. And these were very, very small organizations, and wonderful, wonderful organizations as well, of which, of course, we've all visited and we've all supported since. So that's an example of people, again, channeling their money into frontline small activities run by people who are doing fabulous work.
It sounds like what these two examples have in common is that as a result of channeling their money into these activities, it also brought them into personal contact with people who were doing the work, who were benefiting from the work, and that that opened up and enriched their lives.
Definitely. And, of course, that's back to Helen Steiner Rice, you know, the more you give, the more you get.
Yeah.
And this is one of the not-so-secret things about helping other people, that by helping other people in any way, particularly if you happen to see them or meet them, it deeply enriches your life, and it stops you battering on about what a tough life you've got and all the rest of the nonsense that goes with it, you know. While you're concentrating on helping others, you can hardly worry too much about your own miserable existence.
Yes. Now, I also, another project in which you're currently involved is the same name as your book, and it's also a website, Our Generosity Gene. So yes. Besides being about your book, can you tell us a little bit about what Our Generosity Gene is and what you do through that project?
Well, the secret of that is that... it dawned on me, it sort of morphed, really. It sort of came out of me that actually we are all naturally generous. Now, admittedly, I've had a window on this for several years. But it occurred to me that we are all naturally generous, and that it turns out that all the civilizations from the times of Confucius, you know, literally Confucius wrote about this sort of thing, African tribes and societies, Amazon tribes and societies. I've just been up the Amazon. All the major faiths in the world, Christianity, you know, Hinduism, Islam, they all have two key common links. And the first is they all have a version, literally all of them, of the golden rule, which is to do unto others as you would want to be done by, in other words, to treat other people as you would like to be treated. And the other central teaching they have, and this is completely across the board, is that they all insist on an obligation, that you have an obligation to help people who are less fortunate than yourself. And of course, you know, so to this common teaching, this is not something that Mike dreamt up. We are all naturally generous. And what's happened over the last, you know, few decades is we've all been driven completely witless by being told that we must be independent, we must be self-sufficient, and all of that. And as opposed to being interdependent and collaborating and living together, which is what, of course, all these societies, other societies do. You know, everybody used to work together to look after each other. And in addition to that, we've all been persuaded that we must buy everything that moves and we must accumulate stuff. So we've all been, we've become marketed at, we've become driven by materialism, and we've forgotten that we work much better together. And, you know, I mean, a classic example of that is the service-based community. I mean, there are, you know, thousands of the service-based community that get this, but what's happened is this natural generosity, this natural need to help other people and desire to help other people has basically been derailed. And, you know, so working together and collaborating and playing together and looking after each other is the best way to look after and solve the real challenges that we face today, not by, you know, worrying ourselves about our own ways, and not by not by buying enormous quantities of stuff that we don't really need and don't really want and don't even use half the time.
Yeah.
So the book is an appeal to get back and inspire people to help other people and to recognize that they can.
So, Mike, I have a question. When you use the term generosity, Gene, or as you also say in your book, empathy is built into our DNA. Do you mean that literally? Do you mean that there's actual gene in our DNA, or are you using that as a metaphor?
Well, I mean, there was, there was the history of it's a phrase to describe what I think is our natural status quo before everybody went bonkers.
Yeah.
You know, we are naturally generous, and we have been for thousands of years, and we are, you know, looking after other people and helping other people is part of our DNA. In other words, it's been taught so much by so many people. If you go into, you know, as I say, I was up in the Amazon, in tributaries of the Amazon recently, and it's striking how, you know, when you visit small communities up there, they all work as a community, they all look after each other, and P.S., they're all unbelievably happy. You know, they're not driven by this desire to have things, and they all look after each other. But it's the same in Africa. The African phrase Ubuntu, which is Desmond Tutu, our patron, has written about so much, is, you know, basically it's expressed. There's no English equivalent, but Ubuntu means that we are who we are through other people. We are better than we can live and be better ourselves through other people. In other words, we need other people to make us the best we can be. So it's not really, it's kind of like this is our I believe this is our common state, and then actually, you know, these are the sort of characteristics that we need to solve most of the problems that we face today?
So if generosity is so inherent in human nature and so inherent in indigenous societies, in early societies, then how did we get, you know, in your view, Mike, how did we get so bonkers, as you say, in Western civilization and in liberal, capitalist, global economy that we have today? What has pulled us away from our natural nature?
Well, again, I'd probably have to write another book on that, and I probably won't. But I think, you know, the marketing and advertising to buy all sorts of stuff and be better us and buy bigger cars and bigger houses and borrow money and buy more clothes and all that, the materialistic, the advent of marketing, you know, which is based on persuading us we all need to, you know, to get more and to get debts and loans and worse. I think that's a big factor in derailing everybody, you know. And I think, you know, that we used to work, and of course, societies still do, but we in the West used to work more commonly with each other to solve problems. I don't know, you know, you can never get away. You can never say, well, you know, the wars in the world, what about the wars in the world? What about the people who behave really badly, etc.? You can only decide what you're going to do about it and which side you're on. And I think, you know, it's, I mean, when I started WizKids, I did it as a result of a dare to, and I started the charity. And it's now 25 years old, and it's taken 100 million quid and helped 20,000 children who can't move. When I did it, I thought that was unique, heroic behavior. And it was only as I got a bit older that I realized that there were probably 1 million people plus all over the world who have created enterprises and causes for good, whether it's helping feed people in India or whether it's getting people out of jail. So I think that the media focuses enormously on everything that's wrong with the world, obviously, but there are huge, ginormous quantities of people out there in the world working to make it a much better place. So I'm not sure that it's, I don't think it's probably even exceptional. I thought I was heroic, and then discovered there were millions more like me.
Ah, what a wonderful discovery. you're not alone, right? So many of us discover in service space, you know, that my own impulses to want to help in whatever humble ways I can, that, oh, my God, there are thousands thousands who've been doing this for two decades already, and I can join the party. So I want to ask you this. Okay, so here we are. We humans have the natural, it's built into our nature to want to be generous, to want to help others, and many of us are living in a world, in a civilization where all the messages we get are look out for number one, it's all about me, I've got to be individually successful. So if I'm sort of, and so many of us have found ourselves in the midst of this kind of environment, and if I'm in this kind of environment and I want to cultivate that generosity gene in myself, maybe I've done a little bit, but I want to up my game. I want to be more generous. What do you recommend to people to get started moving in a more generous direction?
Well, I think it's just, I mean, I think it's something that probably, well, we'll find out later, but I think from my experience, it's something that everybody recognizes. Everybody feels much better. If they're having a bad day themselves, or they're having they've hit a wall or they've hit a bump, and someone comes up and puts an arm around them and gives them a hug and makes a fuss, and they realize, you know, they're on the they're on the receiving end of somebody caring about them. And so the shortest answer is to, you know, begin with your family and friends. You know, think about your family and friends. Think about the hard times they're having. Give them a ring. Go and see them. Take them out for coffee. Ask them how they are. Do something dangerously original, like listen to them without giving them your views. You know, you can get, it's a question of getting a grip. There are so many people around doing wonderful things, and I'm sure, you know, the service-based community is completely awash with people doing small acts of kindness. What's that wonderful thing from the Talmud? To save one life is as if you had saved the world.
Yes.
I think people just need to be cheered up and encouraged to do it, and they'll find their own ways. And, you know, and it doesn't involve money. I mean, my mother, it's another lovely story. She got to the age of, we got to her 90s, living alone in a village in England. And there was a young man, who used to come up. He'd been coming up for 25 years to do her garden. When my father was alive, he was called Terry, and he was probably one of the worst gardeners in the world. He was no good as a gardener at all. But he was very good. He came up, mowed the lawn and so on. Then when my father died and my mother got very old, Terry, the village boy, you know, hardly ever went out of the village, he came up to see my mother twice a day and every night, once a day, every night, to make sure she was safe, she could choose a television program, she had a hot water bottle, and that she was all right. And he did this every day for 4 years, every single day. And several times I said to him, you know, Terry, you know, forget about the garden. You know, you're doing something which is quite astonishing. You know, you're being incredibly kind to my mother, and I'm very grateful. And she was, of course, deeply grateful. And he refused to take any money, refused to have anything to do with it. He just said, no, he was very fond of my mother and he wanted to look after her. And, you know, that's a wonderful act of generosity. And then when she died, you know, he said that he'd looked after her because he wanted to help her because he loved her. So that's generosity without, you know, he didn't want anything. You know, he wouldn't take anything. He was just being Terry. Normal, little, no money. He never gave her any money. And he didn't need to give her any money. He was just being wonderfully generous.
What a wonderful example of Terry, a simple gardener who can teach us how to do this. You know, yeah, I'd like to go back 25 some odd years, however much time it is, and the story of you you meeting this disabled kid and then running the marathon, that's well known now. We've read about it and so on. But I'm curious to hear sort of one layer down in depth about that story, Mike. If you would like to share with us a little bit about what your life was like before meeting this boy, and then what are some of your most vivid memories today of what happened, meeting the child, your decision to run the marathon, and what you did immediately after the marathon?
Well, if you describe me aged 40, which was that was the age I was when we ran the marathon, I was basically very ambitious, and I was running a business, and I was focused on the business and making a profit, and, you know, I was terribly busy and terribly self-important and basically not frightfully nice, really. I mean, I probably was nicer than I think, but, you know, I didn't really have much of an altruistic bone in my body. But when we decided to run this marathon, I went up to see, to meet this, is a little girl, actually, who had cerebral palsy. And I went to meet her at her home. And I'd never met a young woman with cerebral palsy in my life before. And she was 12, and she had a very severe speech impediment, and she couldn't move without being moved around by her grandmother. And she was 12, and I was just profoundly moved by the experience. And I came back to London, and I got the friend I was running the marathon with, and we decided that we would do something mildly heroic, run 26 miles to provide mobility for a child who couldn't move at all. And we never trained enough or anything. You know, I'd run 6 miles before we started. But we got to the start line, and some people even sponsored us for crossing the start line. And we set off into the distance with no hope, no idea what we were doing at all. And I finished in 6.5 hours. But we raised £9,500, and we bought this young girl a powered wheelchair, and then we had it delivered to her, and she could move, and she could go around her school, she could go around her shops, she could go around her home, she could whiz about in simple language. And you know, we were as stunned as she was. But we say that it helped change her life, but it completely transformed us, because with no knowledge of what we're doing, again, we started with my wife a children's charity, and the rest of this say is history. And you know, I then began to notice that persuading people to help children who couldn't move very often gave the people who were running marathons, raising money, companies, whatever, they got as much joy out of it as the family and the child who got the equipment. And that led on to this journey, when I realized that what Helen Steiner Rice wrote about was completely true. And then I became a more civilized person as time went on.
I see. However, my understanding is that besides becoming a more civilized person, you also brought some of your business skill and experience with you in WizKids. As you and I had discussed earlier, one of the things that I noticed when I first went onto the WizKids website is that there was no mention of Mike Dixon. You were totally invisible, and I thought, why is that? And you know, and we spoke about your philosophy of leadership, which you had developed in running successful business, and which you brought with you into the organizations that you founded subsequently. And I'm wondering if you can share with us a little bit about your philosophy of leadership and how that has come into play in what you're doing now.
Well, WizKids was basically managed on as close as possible to the model of servant leadership, which is basically the person who's in charge, or the founder, provides the values and the vision of the organization, and then makes sure that the people who are actually doing the work have everything they need to do the work properly. So that's an essence of you know, Robert Greenleaf's work. But the other thing is that, you know, I believe, and it's a personal decision, lots of people agree, lots of people don't, that when you create things, unless you want to stay with them for the rest of your life, success is creating something where you can hand it over to another group of people to run and grow. So after 10 years of running WizKids, for example, we got the most wonderful new chief exec in, who had business experience and was herself in a wheelchair and had been brought up in a children's home, and she's taken it on to another level. I've just done the same thing with Rainmaker. We've got a brand new chief executive who's a very, very successful woman. She's 37 years old. She's great. She's going to take it on and grow it. And so when you're creating things, some people are really good at creating things, but when they get to the stage where they need to grow, they need other talents, other skills, and so on. So And what I've done is focus on starting several different organizations, but then doing succession planning and handing them over to others to grow, because to be brutally frank, I wouldn't be any good at doing it anyway. There are different skill sets needed, but also, you know, I think success is something that, you know, when you've created something that exists without you. So, you know, you have the values and the vision of what you're doing.
And success is something that that can, how do you say, how can stand, how can continue without you.
I mean, WizKids has been going quite merrily on without me for the last 12 years.
That's really...
And I get rung up occasionally, asked to go and give a speech or something, but it's, you know, it's not about me. It's about how well the organization functions to help disabled children move. And so it's not part of Mike's CV. Well, it is, obviously, but it's not important. It's, you know, it's not an ego trip, and neither is Rainmaker. I mean, if Rainmaker is not about me. It's about something that I've helped to create that's doing quite well. And success is getting them all to inspire each other, to help each other.
So this is a very, important feature of your management philosophy, that success is not about me, it's about them. I'm wondering, once you have found younger leaders who have the energy and the desire to move forward on your vision, what role do you see for yourself as the older? Do you continue to have a relationship with them? And if so, what is that like?
Yes, I do. I mean, I do, but increasingly less. So with WizKids, I see the chief executive, you know, 3 times a year, maybe. Just for a meal or coffee or a chat. With Rainmaker, the young woman's just taken over, so I'll be a sort of honorary good thing for about another year, and then she'll be flying solo. So I think the important thing for a founder of anything is to, as I say at the beginning, was to impart how you expect an organization to behave and what you think the vision is, and then pass it on for people to re-energize them and re-evaluate it and so forth. So I think you're responsible for creating it, and you're responsible for its DNA and choosing great people to take it on to another level. And it works.
It certainly has allowed you to reach out to many, many people, many, many situations. And it just personally, that's a lesson that I'm still trying to learn.
I
want to sort of take this in a slightly different direction. You've through Rainmaker and through what you've done, you've dealt with people who deal with charities, you've dealt with the heads of charities that require fundraising and whose work gets fed by a flow of money. And
yep.
My question to you would be, from what you've seen, how is it that people in that kind of role can, you know, provide for their organizations, get the job done, without becoming obsessed by the need to continually get more and more money?
Well, funding is sort of number one issue for all organizations that are trying to do great work all over the world, whether they're trying to sell tigers, save tigers, or whether they're trying to save people. And, you know, there's a wonderful TED talk, which I don't usually by a guy called Simon Sinek, which is about how great leaders inspire. And basically, it's the most important thing is to concentrate on the why the organization exists. As soon as it concentrates on the how and the what, it sort of becomes doomed. So you need the organization to focus on why they're doing it and to always have that up front. And put another way, the philanthropists, people who are backing charities, giving money away, all of them, 100% of them, they always look for someone who is inspirational, running something that is that they firmly believe in, and critically, that they look for someone who is committed to finishing the job, to doing the work. And almost uniquely, they're not remotely interested in how to do it. So in other words, I haven't put that quite as clearly as I meant, but people who are backing organizations look for inspirational leadership and people who are determined to do it. They don't have to know how to do it. So they don't have to know how to do cash flows and PR campaigns and digital media campaigns and all the rest of the mumbo-jumbo, because you can get everybody to do that, but you can't buy inspiration and you can't buy determination to finish it.
Very interesting. So the key is the inspired leader who's inspired to do the work regardless of what's under the hood of the organization. And it sounds like perhaps such an organization needs two types of leaders. It needs the leader who is focused and obsessed with the why, and the other leaders who are paying attention to the how.
Yeah, and it's why succession planning is so important. Is that quite often some of the people who are passionate about their cause, they don't actually ever. They're passionate, but they won't get off. They won't leave. And that actually sometimes stops the organization growing. But by the same token, lots of people who are the reason that an organization exists. But they have to, at one stage or other, they have to build in really strong management and systems in order for their organization to grow. And again, if we had till 9 o'clock, I could list 50 people I know who run wonderful organizations all over the world and the work they do. And they're doing it because of the passion. They are actually, for what it's worth, they're all entrepreneurs. But they're just not doing it for money. They're doing it to change people's lives.
So Mike, here's what I want to ask you. You've had plenty of experience with organizations that run by fundraising, and you've also had experience with organizations and individuals who function on a gift economy. You've spent time with Trishna and Nipun, and you know how service-based functions on a gift economy. So from your seat, as you look at things, what do you see as perhaps both similarities and differences, the way it looks to you, between traditional philanthropies and organizations or communities like Service Space that are in the gift economy space?
Well, I think it's, if you were to take a sort of semicircular arc, I think it's all part of the same thing. So, persuading philanthropists to give some of the money they've earned through their business entrepreneurial efforts and works for good causes is one end, but persuading people to do simple everyday acts of generosity and kindness for their family, friends, people they don't even know, is part of the same thing. So there are hundreds of organizations in the world that are focused on encouraging people to do good. And I think, it's complementary. And I think, the work that a lot of the people in Service Space do on a daily basis, I've had the pleasure of attending Trishna's circles and Annie's and in London. I mean, it's just simply beautiful. And what they do by showing opening their homes and their, and most importantly, their hearts to people is just remarkable. It's wonderfully, wonderfully touching. And Nipun, again, is another, you know, character out of the block, really, isn't he? I mean, he's amazing. And, you know, he's doing the same thing. He's encouraging people to look after other people. And that's what we're all supposed to be doing.
It sounds like, from your point of view, we're all on the same team.
Well, I think it's no doubt about it at all. And that's why it's really important to do conversation medicine, to work together and to share great stories and successes and so forth, so that we can, that we can encourage more people to be useful.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. And I'm going to turn the call now back over to Trishna.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Arye and Mike, both of you. That was a wonderful conversation to eavesdrop on. It felt like you guys were kind of thinking up after catching up a while back. You know, Mike, I wanted to go back to a question I know that I've asked you, and I've really enjoyed listening to your answer. You know, something you said earlier struck me. You said, you know, looking after each other is the best way we can look after ourselves and be generous. And I think that's something you do so effortlessly and naturally. And it's been wonderful to hear a lot about the ways that you have inspired so many others to support charities that you know, and, you know, to come together to help these charities make an impact in the world. And, you know, even I remember coming to your book launch for Our Generous Gene. And, you know, while a lot of book launch events are probably about the author and it's about the journey of that book and how is it going to go out there and make an impact in the world, Mike's book launch event was so unique. His book launch event was about bringing his friends together. So he did this very small, personal, private book launch with his friends, essentially, who he actually wanted to get together. And, you know, it was beautiful, Mike, to see that the purpose for you of the book launch, so much of it was to introduce your friends. I mean, I remember how many different people you came and said, I really want you to meet this person to talk about this to. And it was it was amazing. And you do it so naturally. You're such a natural glue to communities, I think. And one thing that's really inspired me, is how you personally walk your talk. I mean, it's one thing to write books about, you know, what people can do to be generous in their lives. And it's another thing to be so generous in your own life. And I wondered if you could share a little bit about your own kind of personal practices of being the change yourself. Like, what are some of these small things you do in your day-to-day life to be generous? Because I think, I know I've asked you this before, and I'd love for the callers to hear more about it as well, because it's so beautiful. You run these massive organizations that make massive impact, and it'd be great to get that insight into what you do personally day to day to be the change.
Goodness gracious. Well, I mean, Friday, 2 weeks ago, or Friday, not yesterday, but Friday, I was fortunate enough to be able to, I'd asked a group of friends to help another friend that was having a hard time, and they'd all done it. And so on Friday in the morning, I sent out an email to tell them that it had been a success and well done them. So this was practical behavior to help someone who was having a hard time. Somebody rang me up, my next door neighbor rang up to say that her sister was around and was looking to get into the charity world, and, you know, could I see her? And I said, well, I can either do it on Friday or I can do it on, you know, week after I get back from holiday. It turned out to be on Friday. And this extremely elegant and attractive woman turned up, who turned out to be 37. And she was a foreign correspondent for Al Jazeera and goodness knows who else. And she was very elegant and very normal, and we talked and we spoke about getting in the charity world. And it turned out that she'd had three strokes in the last year, one of which had brought her to a halt, and she'd had to learn how to speak and how to walk again. And then another friend of mine rang up and said that somebody else we knew was having a very hard time because her husband had very serious cancer and she was pregnant and they were having to move out of their home and he was going to see her. He ring me back and let me know what we could do about it. So, you know, on next week, three of us will set out to try and help her in practical ways. So I think that, you know, I mean, I could go on really, but, you know, it happens, goes on every day. And the issue is that, you know, one of the most important things from all this is, A, being open to helping people, and B, trust. People have to know that they can trust you. I'm not sure that answers your
question. I wanted to go back to some of the... Yeah, it does. It absolutely does. And I think for those of you who haven't met Mike, I've had the chance to meet him several times here in London. And I think one of the beautiful things that strikes me about you, Mike, is you hold space in your heart for everyone and anyone. You'll have this totally crazy diary of stuff going on and someone calls on you and you'll tell me these stories when we meet. And it's like, oh, you know, this is all going on. And then someone got in touch and I made time to meet them or call them or see them or speak to them or whatever it is that might support them. And I think it's really it's those small acts that you know, kind of sprinkle throughout your day, regardless of how busy it is, that really, I think, make your message come to life for me anyway.
Well, it's interesting because quickly, you remember Satish. I mean, yeah. Satish, I interviewed Satish Kumar about generosity, and he said that he would always make time for anybody. You know, he had a full day. He had to eat. He had to do his meditation. He did his gardening, but he would always see anybody who wanted to see him. He might not see them at the time that the person wanted to be seen, but he'd always see them. And I think, you know, one form of generosity is making sure that you've always got time for someone.
Yeah, definitely.
Sorry, I'm interrupting again. But Satish is really into this as well. Yeah, he goes out of his way.
Yeah. He's very generous with his time. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I wanted to touch on some of your international travels. Like, I know you've been all over the world to see so much work in action. And I wondered if you could share a couple of tidbits about what you've learned from your international travels to Africa, Brazil, India, all these places you've been to. What have you learned from these travels about our inherent generosity?
Well, I mean, I think two examples. I mean, in India, I visited many charities, but one very powerful one is called Ashtaya Patra, and it was started by the head of the Hare Krishnas, can you believe, and the financial director of Infosys, so two completely contrasting cultures. And anyway, they created an organization that feeds 1.5 million children every day in their schools with a hot meal. And they make the meals all night, and then they put them in boxes and heated vans and deliver the vans to the schools so that the children go to school because they're going to get fed and they eat properly, so they grow properly and learn properly. Anyway, the killer story of this is that to feed one child with a hot meal every day for a year costs £7.50, which is the price of two cappuccinos in London. So that's an example of somebody, you know, people who are focused on helping people and doing it efficiently. Down the other end, we've just been to these communities in the Amazon, and what's particularly striking, you know, we had our own little boat and crew, and what's particularly striking, and when you land in these communities, they do dances and shows for you and all this sort of thing, but they tell you about their lives and their values, and they are, you know, their values are handed down from one generation to another generation, and they're all incredibly, the sense of community is incredibly strong. They all work for each other and help each other. And they are wonderfully happy, and they don't want everything. As to supporting organizations throughout the world, the closer you can, you know, it's an art form, and you know, you have to try really hard to make sure it gets to the people who need it. And that, you know, you could write another book on that.
Thank you, Mike. We have Wendy on the line, who is also in Half Moon Bay, California. Wendy, if you wanted to share your question for Mike.
Yes, thank you, and it's a wonderful conversation. I've got a comment and a question. My comment first is, what's really interesting, what I'm listening to is in the Rainmaker organization, that people are actually brought together in relationship, and to so that they can really do some great work together, and it sounds like some of these relationships are lasting long term. And to me, that seems so much more satisfying than if I see a cause on the computer and I, you know, make a donation with my charge card. But just actually meeting the people who are doing the work, I think, is very fulfilling. So I really do want to commend Mike for that. My question is, how do you, with all the difficulties in the world and all the great causes, there's so many wonderful causes and organizations, how do you avoid overwhelm, and how are you able to keep focus on what really needs to be done in the world? Thank you.
That's right. Well, you know, to your first point, it's interesting because introducing the people to the leaders of various charities is great, but also introducing them to each other is great. So they all get together and they meet very often during the year, and they quite often have lunch together. They have, you know, they have events together, and so in at its simplest, you would get six or seven people all passionate about the environment, meeting each other and helping the environment. So giving as part of a group is a very is as good for the people who are giving. You know, they learn a lot and they learn a lot. And they feel a lot jollier about meeting the charities they're going to help. To your second point, of course you could be overwhelmed, but there are two things. First of all, we tend to work out what the people who want to give would be most interested in. So some people, you know, are interested in the education of disadvantaged youth, for example. So we tend to search out and know charities that help disadvantaged youth. And we know the people who run the organizations, and we visited the organizations. And ditto in India. You know, if somebody has been to India, we have an Indian donors, we now know about 40 organizations in India that are very well run and run by inspirational people. You know, it is a big problem, because in any particular area, there are thousands of different organizations that you could choose. So you can only do it by research, recommendation, and to a certain extent, trial and error.
Well, thank you so much. I really am enjoying this phone call.
That's very good. Thank you very much for ringing in.
Thank you, Wendy. Just a reminder to callers, you can dial *6 to get into the Q&A queue. We had one live comment from Berkeley, Mike. Mac Lingo has shared, so what has changed between you before you started being who you are now? What was something that created that shift that led you to become the kind and lovely and generous person you are now?
Well, I think in very simple terms, it could be tracked back literally to the time that I met the young girl who had cerebral palsy. You know, I was profoundly moved. I'd never met anybody. I'd never met a disabled child before. I'd never met anybody with cerebral palsy before. And that whole experience of meeting her was profoundly moving. And then being able to contribute a little bit, which is all it is, really, mobility, and being able to summon a group of friends around to fund an electric-powered wheelchair for her so she could move around, just was a very profoundly moving experience for all of us. And so that was, if you like, Act 1, Scene 1. It was very, oh, good Lord, you could actually do something useful. It was very exciting.
Yeah, I can imagine. I wanted to go back to something you had shared around Arya's question on leadership and organizations, and you know your comment about how you can't buy inspiration. That's such a beautiful way to put it. You know, there's so many things you can buy, so many resources you can buy to support an organization. Inspiration is not one of them. And you talked about values being an important, you know, an essential ingredient to like helping organizations to thrive and to inspire others to be generous. I wondered if you can elaborate a little bit on what you think those values are that you kind of really held space for in your various organizations that have kind of created the ripples that they have in the world.
Well, I mean, gosh, off we go again. I mean, I think the first thing is that everybody who works in the organization has to know the purpose of the venture. You know, they have to know why they're all coming to work, and they all have to, after that, they all have to be involved in the decision-making processes around their own work and in their own work. And so they become engaged and involved, which doesn't mean to say that they all have to think that the person in charge is a hero all the time. And it doesn't mean to say that the person who's in charge has to do what they say. But what it does mean is everybody understands the direction of the organization, why it's there and what it's, and that they feel involved in it. And when that takes place, it's a longer process than telling people to do something and making them get on with it. But once they're engaged, involved, and they know the purpose of the venture, and they have a say, generally speaking, things become very powerful. As I say, it's quite important that, it, from a leader's point of view, it doesn't become a popularity contest. We're not paid to be popular. So, you know, there are reasons why everybody might think you should do something which you won't do. But it is important to consult. And generally, success is when you decide to do something that they don't agree with, but they still trust you, having had their say. So, as I said, it's not a popularity contest, but it works quite well if you do it properly.
Right. We have a question from a caller in Berkeley.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Mike, or good evening.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
My name is Bradley. Thank you, first of all, for the call.
It's a pleasure.
I guess what my question is just the other day I was doing something and I was thinking about if I wanted to do it. And I was talking to a friend, and they said something to me like, "There's always got to be a reason for you to do something." And they said, and I thought about it, although not always. I said, "Well, yeah, I guess when I'm going to do something, I want to think about why I'm doing it." And I think sometimes that actually holds me back from. I guess if I can't come up with an intrinsic reason for doing something, it's like, okay, I don't want to do this because, you know, what am I gaining from it? A friend the other day said, that's very nice of you. He said, that's a lot of karma points for you.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, that's not why I'm doing it, I hope. but I guess my question about intention and generous acts, whether it's giving money or giving time or just giving space, and how important do you, I mean, am I overthinking it? Just go ahead and do it. Don't worry about your intention.
Yeah, I think you are. I think it sounds to me like you're of good heart. So I'd say just get on with it. You know, you don't need to think about it, really. I suspect you, you know, you just need to have a word with yourself. just do it. Don't talk about it. Just get on with it. And don't worry what anybody else says either. You know, if you're struck by, you know, by a heart thing, you know, not a head thing, it's a... if you're struck by a desire or an idea to do something useful or help someone, I'm just going to do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that any use? Is that any use? I don't know. It is really, but I mean, it's just, you know, it's just a good thing to do.
No.
Just do it.
No.
It's the heart, not the head.
That is how it is.
Yeah.
Like that, when I seem to be judging myself, and then I don't want to think about why other people are doing things because then I'm judging them. And so that's very helpful. Thank you.
just,
I was going to say that I feel like so often our head gets in the way, right, of our heart. And it's that moment where you just jump and respond without letting your head get in the way, right? That happens to me all the time, I feel like, where maybe you pass someone who's homeless or, you know, whatever it is, some situation presents itself and you start thinking about it. And you're like, should I do this? Should I not do this? What should I do about it? Whereas, like, I feel like if I just stop thinking about it and just do what like my first instinct is, like I feel like I can actually follow my intention in my heart without letting the head get in the way.
It's that Latin expression, carpe diem, seize the day, get on with it.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. We have our next question from California as well.
Hi, uh-huh. Mike. My name is Audrey. I'm calling from Berkeley, right. California as well, and it's been really nice to hear your perspectives. I especially loved your insights on how success is when you're creating something and you just kind of give it to someone else. In a way, you like share it with others to grow. And my question is related to on the profile of you on the Awaken site. Listed one thing on your bucket list as going on a spiritual sabbatical, like a month on Christian retreat or a month learning how to meditate, maybe at an ashram in India. And I'm curious to just hear a little bit more about that. Could you share a little bit more about that? And I was also really interested in kind of your openness and, you know, the different faiths and learning about that. So could you share a bit about, I don't know, did you have a faith growing up and how has that evolved and what makes you kind of want to go on a spiritual sabbatical?
Well, I mean, to start with, my current life and in the last few years has been organized by Google Calendar. And, you know, it's like every hour is done for some reason or other, and it's become a nightmare. And every now and then I do actually get it cleared for about 3 weeks, and I say I'm only going to see people who are very important or people who are having a hard time, and everybody who works with me just raises their eyes in horror, but it works pretty well. So I think that, you know, amongst the busyness of the world, I think we need some time off. And I'd love to do a spiritual retreat in any form, just to get peace and quiet and think about things other people or myself. So as far as the Christian part's concerned, you know, I went to school and went to church and all that, and went to church on Sundays and, yeah, Christmas time and Easter and so forth. But then there was a long gap. And then we, in our late 30s, my wife and I had our children christened. And we went to this church where the chap, who was a curate, quite reasonably, suggested we might like to turn up to learn something more about Christian faith. So we did. And then we started going to a church about the age, I was about 40 then. Started going to a local church, and there was lots of prayer involved, and I found it altogether very threatening, you know, being an independent little chap. You know, I thought there might be a spiritual answer to life. And then gradually over the last, you know, X years, you know, I've learnt more about faith, which I would describe probably as 10% level. And I'd like to learn more. And I think whether, you know, I'd like to do retreat and to learn more about spiritual life values. But I'd also love to go to an ashram or, you know, whatever. I think it's a sort of inner need, really.
Mm.
What about you?
About me? I never really grew up with a religious tradition, so I've always been really interested in just being open to a lot of different faiths, you know, whether it's going with a friend for, you know, at her Jewish temple, or, you know, or a Christian service, or Unitarian Universalist service, or going to a meditation retreat. It's always been really interesting, and I think in recent years I've really kind of been more interested in, or found it beneficial for my own daily life to learn how to meditate. So
yeah,
that's kind of what I've been interested in lately. But I'm just always really curious about people's kind of, I don't know, maybe faith traditions or spiritual traditions. So that struck me.
Well,
so thank you.
Well, one of the things you'll find is I discovered when we were doing the book is that actually if you dig not very far below the surface of every single major faith and all, you know, societies, whether they've been Africa or the Amazon or China or anywhere, is that actually the values are unbelievably similar. They're all the same.
Right, yeah.
It's just, see, it's kind of like, it's almost as if, you know, in fact, you know, this, as I said, this, at the beginning, you know, that they all have a version of the golden rule, which is to look after people as you would like to be treated, and they all have an obligation to help people less fortunate than yourself, and that's just two of the common shared values. So, you know, I wouldn't worry too much about the which particular division it is. You know, just it's more. You know, even within, we have churches in this country, this is sort of Church of England, and within the Church of England, there are, within our own neighbourhood, I live in Notting Hill Gate in London, and, you know, within the same, it's lots of different churches with different values and different practices, you know, they've got different ways of doing the same thing, really. You just have to find one that suits you.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
That's
right. Thank you, Audrey, and thank you, Mike. As we're approaching the end of the call, I wanted to share, Mike, a comment that came online from Mish, who is one of our amazing community members for Kindspring, which is our Smile Card website. Mike, what do you know about Smile Cards? And Mish is this amazing, amazing woman who looks after the entire community of like thousands and thousands of people. And she wanted to share with you that every week after these amazing calls, her husband asks her, okay, who was today's speaker and what have you learned from them? And she wants you to know that today she is going to share with him that today's speaker is a ripple maker, a person who sparks the sparks in others, and a creator of generosity networks. Deep gratitude for seeding our world with generosity blooms. In smiles, Mish from New York City.
Well, wherever Mish is, if you're still listening, Mish, please send me an email, because I'd love to know more about you. You can put me in touch with Mish, or Mish can put me at you.
Of course,
whatever.
I can.
I'd love more of Mish. Is what's required. I'd love to know more about Mish.
I'll definitely put you in touch. And Mike, you know, one thing we ask all of our guests, because Service Space is really about serving everybody's journeys, what can we do as a larger Service Space community to support your work?
Well, I think the first thing, I mean, roughly three things, I think that if everybody who was in the service-based community engaged with the rather special service-based community, that would be great. So keep doing that. From my own point of view, I think spreading the word, dare I say it, buying the book, The Generous Gene, let me know what you think. But most important, probably third of all, is to do something generous in the next few weeks and tell the story, you know, on the Generous Gene Facebook page and like it and all the rest of the stuff and share it on your own social media. In other words, you know, what would be really lovely to come out of this call, apart from selling books, would be wonderful stories of people who've done things that have surprised them. Perhaps like one of the guys whose name I've sadly forgotten, who was we were talking to a few calls back. You know, some you go and do something, you know, throw your heart over the hedge and go and follow it, and then tell us what's happened, because the stories are incredibly powerful. And I think that's what I'd like. What would be really good is to get as many people as possible to do something generous for other people in the next few weeks and tell us all about it.
Oh, well, thank you for that, Mike, and we'll all be sure to pay forward your generosity.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the call. I think one of my kind of soundbite takeaways from the call is looking after each other is the best way we can look after ourselves and be generous. And I think that's such a beautiful message to send out into the world from someone who creates such huge impact and can boil it down to something so simple that we can all access. So thank you so much for that, Mike. As
well,
is tradition
you.
On these calls. Oh, of course, of course. And I look forward to
you
offline
well.
Here. Of course, and thank you,
Arye. Is Arye still with us?
He should be still with us. Yes, thank you, Arye, for holding space for such a beautiful conversation to unfold.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your patience. Thank you all.
Of course. Of course, of course. We typically end our calls with a minute of silence in gratitude to you, Mike, and to Arye, and to all of our callers for collectively holding this space together. So I will start the minute of silence now. And at the end, what we'll do is I'll unmute everybody, and we can all say our collective gratitude to Mike together. Two, three.
Thank you, Mike.
Namaste.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. We'll see you on another Awaken call.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.